I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every single educator we have on this show, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by you, the folks who listen. So we want you to be a part of this show with us. Please tell us about the educators who inspire you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight, and email us with your nominations. Nominate those teachers at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And today on the show, it's my conversation with Dr. Lisa Fazio-Thelk. She's a psychology professor at Waubonsie Community College, and Lisa recently won the college's Outstanding Faculty Award. And we had a great conversation about how her experience in the field working at a psychiatric hospital informs her current work in the classroom. And we talk about how she walks into her Psych 100 classes every fall, a little bit mean, to show students how misguided their first impressions often are.
I tell them, turn the paper over and write your first impressions down. And it's not very nice. Oh, they're being real, Beryl.
Yeah,
there's a good handful. The sighs and the gasps when I finally put up the questions, I'm like, now we're really gonna get to know me.
We also talk about why she loves the unique social and academic environment of a community college. We talk about teaching students how to de-stress and so much more. But before we get to that conversation, we have another education story we want to share. More than 330,000 Illinois residents are projected to lose Medicaid coverage due to the new One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And I wanted to explain how Medicaid funds education services and what those cuts could mean. At Malta Elementary in DeKalb, Stephanie Schmidt guides one of her students through a speech lesson. She's a speech-language pathologist.
Can you say, I play in the snow?
I play in the snow. No.
Nice. Speech is one of the many education services schools rely on Medicaid to help pay for. Teachers like Schmidt provide therapy, and Medicaid reimburses the school a certain amount to help recoup the cost. Medicaid is K-12 education's fourth largest federal funding source. Lisa Davidson-Becker is the DeKalb School District's Assistant Director of Student Services.
So for example, fiscal year 2023, we were able to get reimbursed just over $800,000. So it is a significant amount. We're able to use some of that money to offset some of the costs for the salary for some of our related service, speech pathologists, nurses, things like that.
She says they can also use the money to buy assistive technology and therapy tools. And while the new law doesn't directly cut Medicaid funding, people are expected to lose coverage because it adds extra paperwork to keep proving employment status. And the state taxes providers like hospitals to help cover the cost of services paid with Medicaid dollars. But the new law also limits how much they can tax these providers, and it stops the state from creating new ones. The nonpartisan health policy group KFF projects it'll lead to a roughly $48 billion decline in Medicaid spending in Illinois over the next decade, including less money for schools. And in a recent nationwide school survey, 70% of respondents said they expect Medicaid cuts would result in reductions and layoffs of school health staff, and over 60% said they expect a reduction in resources like assistive technology for kids with disabilities. And in DeKalb, Davidson-Becker says it's still too soon to know the new law's impact, but she says the need for these services grows every year.
We're certainly ready to still provide those services, but we're going to have to be creative on how we would fund those if we see Medicaid cuts.
That's not the only way Medicaid intersects with the education system. Medicaid is also the second largest funder of early intervention services in Illinois. Early intervention provides developmental services like speech and occupational therapy for kids up to 3 years old. And about half of children receiving these services in Illinois use Medicaid. Haley Mason is an adjunct professor at Aurora University and spent 17 years as an early intervention service coordinator.
The systemic issue here is not just losing the Medicaid dollars. You're losing providers. You're losing hospitals and therapy locations that these children are able to receive services that are paid by early intervention. In rural areas, we're already at a shortage, right, of providers spread across how many children they have to treat.
Right now, Illinois children qualify for early intervention when they have a delay of 30% or greater in a certain developmental area, whether it be cognitive, physical, or communication. And Mason's worried that if the cost burden is shifted more onto the state, they might have to raise the threshold for qualification, which would mean fewer kids receiving therapy.
I'm so far above any level of concern that would be on a chart. Scared is probably the best word to describe. I am angry and scared that people don't understand the impact of these cuts.
She says Medicaid is also crucial to providers because those reimbursement rates have gone up over the past few years, while some payments from private insurance have decreased. Overall, Mason says these cuts will cost taxpayers money because when children don't get early intervention, they end up requiring more expensive services later on. And in a statement to WNIJ, a spokesperson for the Illinois Department of Human Services said they're concerned that federal Medicaid cuts will shift more of the cost to the state, which could make the system unstable for providers and reduce access to early intervention. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Waubonsie Community College psychology professor, Dr. Lisa Fazio-Thelk.
I forget if I mentioned this to you over the email, but I went to school here.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
And I realized, not until I walked in today, that not only did I go here, I took a Psych 101 class in this building.
Did you?
11 years ago. Yeah.
Who was your teacher?
Hollenbeck.
Oh, he just retired. He was right next door.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah.
So yeah, like that would have been the fall of 2014.
Yeah. He just retired. Yeah. And he, I mean, we're very, very good friends. He was the officiant for my son's wedding.
Oh, no kidding, really?
Yeah. Because I mean, we worked so close together. He knew my whole life, you know. So it was good to have someone officiate that knew what I was up to, my family was up to, my kids, what they were up to, so it worked out good.
That's awesome. I was trying to remember what are the things that if I can pull anything from that class, like what do I remember? And honestly, one of the things that I remembered was that he told an anecdote about being like his family throwing a surprise birthday party for him.
And fright and flight.
Yeah. Right, and him like thinking that there was a home invasion happening and that he needed to grab like his baseball bat for that. So I did take, from 11 years ago, I do still have that handy. Yeah.
I was there and it was pretty, none of us, ironically, in psych like surprises.
Really?
We're not a big fan because I think that's the lack of not knowing, the lack of like
control.
Not having control, of a situation. Yeah.
Oh, well, that does make sense though.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I
also
think so.
Really funny that you were there for that.
I was. So, yeah.
Did he really come in like with a baseball bat?
His face was like fight. He was gonna fight, and I was like, look. I looked at him like, what the hell?
That's really funny. Yeah. So I got here a little bit early and I was looking at my notes and everything. I was walking around. I saw that you guys do have the little like psychology department display up with some like helpful quotes, including, which I did not know, that oranges are stress relieving.
Yeah.
I had no idea, which I'm so glad about how much I enjoy citrus stuff.
Well, there you go. I begged for that because we had so many things that I wanted the students to see in this building. You know, and just being a part of the building because we're up here away from everything, you know, the offices and stuff. So I wanted to be an entity down there when they first walked in. So they knew, you're in the right place. Psych is here.
Yeah. Well, and that I was thinking about that. Right. Like you guys have, as a psychology department, you have this expertise when it comes to mental health and stress relief and things like that.
Yeah.
And about how you take those skills to help out in the broader school community outside of the classroom setting. I just saw that you guys have like a kind of a mental health week and things like that you guys do. Is that something that has always been a thing for you? Or is that something that over the course of your time here, you've gotten to incorporate more and more into the kind of the larger school?
The mental health week, we've always been, in the past, the counselors would initiate that and start that and really, really advertise that. And then we've been a big component to help, with that. I started the psych club when I got here because in the early years, I started at Triton College and I didn't have the GPA to be in an honor society.
Right.
So I felt like not having the psych club was only allowing honor students to be part of a club for our department.
Right.
So Psych Club admits anybody and everybody that's interested in psych. And so we started that so that we can also be advisors and mentoring them in, you know, community. And like our psych club and Psi Beta, we have won awards for the last 2 or 3 years with different things we've done for the community, different things we've done here. I was honored with getting the advisor of the year. And so, because we were doing Narcan training, I started Narcan training for the whole community, meaning in here, like anybody, not just psych.
Right.
But the psych club was sponsoring that.
Yeah.
And then we started a revival and survival of the community program last year. And we had a silent auction and set that up online. And we raised over $1,000 for food insecurities for the students here by selling items that the students donated.
And that's a really fun perspective, specifically at a community college, saying that you're a part of a larger community outside of your classroom. Because, again, community college to me is, someone that went here and went through that experience, it is such a unique academic and social environment. Mm-hmm. That of course you get the traditional 18 to 19 year olds who are coming out of high school,
right.
Who,
but
then you also get people in their late 20s who are out of the military, or people in their 40s or whatever that are changing careers. Like, you really get a pretty unique academic and social situation that really you don't have almost anywhere else in education.
No, and that's why I like working here. And I, the non-traditionals, students that are, out of their 20s, for them to take on a task to most likely having a family, right? And taking care of a family and then coming back to school. So I do very much want to be a part of for them to succeed.
Yeah.
And so I do help them and mentor them and, organization. And they come in my office. I still get letters from students that have graduated thanking me or saying, thank you for your words of encouragement, and here's where I'm at, and this is what I'm doing. And that makes it all worth it right there. It's all about the students. Someone asked me once, why do you want to accept the nomination or the awards for, outstanding faculty? I'm like, because the students want me to. The students nominated me, and so I feel like that's about them.
Right.
And right out of high school, that's a learning curve in a sort of a sense. It's you don't have bells telling you that, oh, it's time to get up, or it's time to do this, it's time to go to this class or eat lunch. And so I've always apply all those, organizational skills of our day. My favorite thing is, like myself, when I was in community college, I was also working.
Yeah.
And so,
for sure.
And I really get that. And I understand that. And so I want to be that bridge for the students, either it be, older students or right out of high school students, just be that bridge that, maybe that one person that tells them, you can do this.
Yeah. And so again, at the beginning of a school year, when you're having brand new group of kids coming into a class, kids, again, I say it was adult people who are in these kinds. You have a whole different group that is coming in, and to, help guide them through that, to be that bridge, you do have to, establish a rapport and establish trust with them pretty early on. And so, you've been doing this for a long time. I'm curious about how you think of that early part of the year as, again, you're asking them to dive into these,
mm-hmm.
Really deep personal issues about, how they think about themselves and things like that. How to establish that level of trust with a classroom, again, full of a very diverse group of people. How do you do that? And has that changed the way you think of that? Has that changed over your career?
It actually hasn't. I think I had that, pretty solid in the beginning. In my intro class, are typically in the fall, especially their very first college psych class.
Mm-hmm.
And I come in there raging, like a raging bull. And I pass out the syllabi, and they'll say thank you, and I'll just look at them, and I come in there because my first chapter is first impressions, social psych. And we all make our first impressions, and I just want students to immediately be aware of this and be to understand that first impressions are probably not always going to be correct. And so I'll say, read the syllabus, and somebody will look up. I'm like, you've done reading already? I'm like, I'm kind of mean. And, you know, some of the face, and I feel really bad, you know, but
still,
every single year, I'm afraid someone's going to stand up and be like, you're just mean. I'm getting out of here. You know, no one has yet. And so then what I do, and I know that other people said it's not story time and it's not, you know, not about me, but the only way to break through that, I don't want to say fear, but maybe anxiety of being in college, is to be real. And I am exactly who I am when I'm at home, and when I'm here, I'm real. And so afterwards I said, okay, I tell them, turn the paper over and write your first impressions down. So they write their first impressions, and it's not very nice. And they're even looking at me like,
are they being real about it?
Oh, they're being real, real.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a good handful that's really real about it. And not so many nice words that I'm like, is anybody going to share? There's always that one, that which would have been me, that I would have no problem sharing. And so I say the word that everybody's thinking, and they look at me and I'm like, was that your first impression? And I said, okay. I said, and the sighs and the gasps when I finally put up the questions, I'm like, now we're really going to get to know me. And so I say, how old am I? I don't care. It's just a number. I feel like I've been through a lot in life, so I don't really care how old I am. I say, how old am I? What are my favorite activities to do? Am I married? And they say, oh yeah, you're married, you have rings on. And I said, is that a first impression? Maybe I have rings on because I don't want anyone to think I'm not married.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh. And so I'm real. I get that, get them to get to know me on a personal level. And the gasp, like I said, the gasp, they're like, oh, like that's like, they're so relieved. And I said, how many of you are going to like leave here and drop the class? It's the majority of the class would raise their hand. And I said, well, I mean, you know, drop the class and be done with it. They're like, yeah, we thought you were very strict. And I'm like, well, I said, all I have to do is follow the rules. I said, but I'm here to help you succeed. I'm not going to be like that. They're like, oh, thank God. They're like, you know, I mean, I can put on a good show, you know. And so I do that, and I am real. And I think the biggest thing I do is theory is theory. And theory is important, right? But I think the most important thing is that I share my experience, all the years working in the field, with the theory. And I say to them, I'm like, I'm not going to sit here and read a textbook to you. I'm not going to read a PowerPoint to you. But I promise you, you will take something from this class that you'll be able to apply later in your life. So I use my examples and attach them to theory. So they remember the examples. They never forget that, right? They never forget an example. And then that should trigger maybe on a test or in, you know, something else, you know, in future psych classes, it will trigger, Lisa's example was, and then they'll remember, you know, what was behind that example.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's not story time, but I do feel like I don't like lecturing. I don't like using that word. I don't lecture. I don't talk to them. You know, we talk together. I learn from them too. Lots of things I learn from them. And so that's how I start my intro class. And the other class is similar, but I don't come in there because most of them are, I say, repeat followers. They, like, follow me to class to class. So they kind of know, you know, the whole.
They know the shtick at that
point. They know at that point.
Yeah, if it's their third class, you right. can't come in and be like, listen up.
Yeah, that, no. But, I mean, but even if the newer ones in the developmental classes, because I teach all the developmental, and I started adolescent psych and adulthood and aging.
Yeah.
And I do child psych and lifespan. But I do the same thing, answering questions about myself and if I have kids. And, you know, just knowing that I am a person and I'm human. And I even tell them, I'm like, if I, you know, the chairs are on wheels. And I'm like, if I fall and miss the chair, you can laugh. But then can you please come help me because I'm getting old? You know, they're like, oh, well, I hope that doesn't happen. And I mispronounce words. I'm not perfect.
Yeah.
And I would never stand up anywhere and like I'm better than them or I'm perfect and I don't make mistakes. I'm only human. I have good days and I have bad days and I mispronounce words and, you know, I'm like, did I just say that? I'm like, I think I just made up a word today. I mean, and I think that keeps them at a balanced level, you know, and not scaring them and making them anxious. Yeah. You know, then I'm human and I know this, we're going to learn a lot and you're going to learn and I'm going to learn from you and we're going to have a good time.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, where it might not be story time necessarily, yeah, but you know, these topics and you know, the themes and things we're trying to get across are inherently personal.
Yeah.
So
for sure.
Of course, that's going to be a way that it's going to be easy to connect those things. Correct. And make people feel real. Because I think that, again, like when people are coming in for like, you know, my first psych class, mm-hmm, or they've never been in there before, you know, again, like the topics and themes we're going over about our behavior and emotions, yeah, and managing our lives, like that is so essential to who we are. But I don't think that people always draw a direct line to say this psychology class is going to help me better be able to do those, correct, things.
And intro to psych especially. So I've had morticians in there that want to be morticians, and I had auto body students in there. I mean, you name it, they have to take it. That's psych 100. And they, typically, they choose psych 100. And so I really do curtail my classes and how I present so that everybody can see that it is meaningful and that it can apply to our real life, to our life. And it's not just, because the intro to psych, you know, it's quite the gamut of topics, like,
yeah,
from behavior to the brain, to the nervous system, to, I mean, you name it, it's in there.
It's kind of a daunting overview to prioritize.
It is extremely daunting. But how, again, like I say, I love biology and I was loved biology in college and anatomy, and but I'm not the biology teacher here, but I am going to teach you how the biological basis of our behavior, and so I curtail it to go to behavior, again staying within, you know, my teaching, you know, expertise.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a huge range of teachers who we've talked to on the show, right? Like everything from college professors like yourself to, you know, early childhood teachers, mm-hmm, you know, elementary school teachers, dance and music instructors, and everything in between. It's really extremely interesting. I always, like, obviously we ask people about why they became teachers in the first place. And so we get everything from people who came to it much later on in their life, maybe even changed a career, to, you know, people that had stuffed animals set up into a little classroom when they were kids, or yeah, roped, yeah, one of their siblings in there and, like, yeah, you know, passed out fake little assignments to, yeah, them in, like, yeah, elementary school. I mean, again, we can go into why teaching and then we can go into why psychology specifically. But for you, how did you come to teaching? Was it something you wanted to do for a long time, or did you come to it a little bit later?
I honestly I worked in a state psychiatric hospital for 13 years within the educational rehabilitation department. And so I had a lot of background with that. And then later started like doing groups and things like that. And then I worked in crisis and with families throughout King County, all about the same time. And I did play school growing up and I loved it. And my mom bought me a big chalkboard that you could flip to a blackboard, to a green board, and, you know, the little chalk holder to teach penmanship. And I mean, I had the whole thing set up, but I never really wanted to be a teacher. I don't know why. I never thought about it. And I think that with some of my experience early on in life, it, you know, in grade school and high school, and then I took psychology courses. I'm like, I really like this. And I always felt like I was the one in school that I couldn't tolerate anybody leaving anybody out of a group, or I couldn't tolerate anybody being upset, or someone upsetting someone, or bullying. And, you know, I always looked after in one way or another, like the underdogs, right? And I think then I realized that maybe some of these experiences and things is what I should do, is, you know, try to assist people and work with people. And so I always was going to get my PsyD in psychology. But then I went went to school, finished my bachelor's, and then I started my master's in human services psych. I got another master's degree, and then I worked through my PhD. But the human services psych, well, human services was more of like the counseling side.
Right.
And so I really felt like I really liked that. I liked that part of it. But to be honest, because I was working in crisis throughout King County, and that was with police departments and an agency, I think I would now I have three babies, two toddlers and an infant, and I saw and felt like that was taking its toll on me. So working in psychiatric facility for 13 years, along with the crisis and working in, you know, being on call, it was starting to take a toll on me. So I thought, well, if it's taking a toll on me, it's probably going to take a toll on my family.
Yeah.
And so I was actually floating in my pool one day, and I was reading back in the day the paper and saw an advertisement.
Remember the paper?
Do you?
Barely, yeah.
I saw a employment opportunity, and I actually live across the street. And I asked my husband, I said, Mike, is Mobansi right over here? And he's like, yes, Lisa. And I'm like, oh, because we just moved out here.
Okay,
and I grew up like near Melrose Park, you know, and so I wasn't sure about all the surrounding areas. And I said, well, they're looking for a psych instructor. And he's like, well, then just apply. So I did. And I applied, and I don't know how long it was. They had called me and said, you know, were you interested in teaching intro to psych? And I'm like, sure. You know, I didn't even know what I was saying yes to. Apparently what I was saying yes to was, it was called at the time a three-way tick. So I was in Bodie and in the classroom, but then I had cameras on me. Yes, on me. And then streaming back in the day. Big, huge thing, right?
Yeah.
To Aurora and Copley. So I had students in Aurora and Copley campus and then students in front of me. That's how I started teaching. And I actually fell in love with it. I felt like, you know, let's try it and let's see what happens. And I always, still to this day, look at my student evaluations. And if my students are liking it, then I'm doing something right. And if they're not liking something, then I'm going to change it up, right?
Yeah.
And I had good student evaluations, and then full-time job came about. And at that point, I was exhausted. I was exhausted working in the field. And I never suggest anybody working in those two fields together for that long. And so I decided that I was going to, someone was retiring, and I was going to apply. And that's the history of that, you know. I guess it just kind of fell in my lap, but I always say this is my retirement. Like, I don't plan on ever retiring. This is my retirement. I've worked all those years as a young lad, right? Very long, very, very young, in the field. And when I've been here since 2005, I think.
20 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I don't even keep track. People make fun of me for not keeping track of that. Because I really do enjoy it. And I do have a lot of passion for that. Even if I make a difference in one person a semester, I'm good with that. You know, I'm good. I have a lot of passion for the field, and I have a lot of passion for my students.
Is, after that experience that you had in the field, did you feel like there was a lot of overlap in the skill set once you transitioned into the classroom?
Oh, absolutely. For sure. I mean, I use a lot of examples from them, from both, you know, the parents, the children, and the from the psychiatric hospital, same thing. A lot of the experience and a lot of the examples come from that. And it's not that I didn't like the job and I didn't do good. I was offered a full-time job in both positions, and then this full-time job came up. So, you know, I really had to do like little identity crisis, I call, you know, which is a good thing.
Right. Well, yeah.
And I'm trying to see like what would be for me and my family, what would be the most sustainable. That, you know, I could stay, you know, a good wife and a good mother and a good daughter, a good daughter-in-law, you know. And I'm very grateful that I had this opportunity and took it, you know, because it was, but the experiences, well, I'll never forget them.
I'm always interested in how, like, educators evolve over their career. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure you have very different examples, too, right, than you had 20 years ago, and about how you know, especially in a class like psychology, where again, we're talking about these very personal things about how, you know, naturally you're going to change as an educator and your perspective is going to change as, yeah. as you get older and as your life changes, as your perspective changes. I'm curious if that's something that you've noticed about yourself too.
My perspective changing as a teacher.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I say teacher, but teachers are really smart because they like know all the like math and English, you know? And so I sure. always say, you know, yes, as a professor, I have, you know, I have my own little wheelhouse and I, you know, teach based on my experiences, like I've said, but I definitely see as the world changes.
Of course, obviously.
Of course I would have to adapt. Like, you know, when COVID came around, I was one of maybe 8 of us that had come back right away in the big rooms and separated the distance and wearing the masks. That was tough. And so I thought to myself...
That changes the social atmosphere, obviously.
Absolutely. And I, you know, didn't recognize students when they finally took their masks off. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't, you know, the face is huge, you know, a smile. And, you know, we smile with our eyes, but just the face. But so, yeah, I mean, I recognized that I was having difficulty, so I needed to recognize they also were going to be having a difficulty. And then when we all came back, everything opened up, it was a whole new world there too, because now we've been isolated and now we're back. So, you know, I took and evolved into group projects, you know, getting for the, which most people don't like, but isn't life a group?
I mean, so maybe I loved a group project.
Did you? Were you the one that worked all the time?
Yes, it was. Okay, yeah, good. I was also happy to insert myself as the leader of the group activity whenever.
Those guys, you guys always do good, right? but group projects more so because I wanted, I still do it to this day. So I want students to see that, you know, pretty much every job you have, if it's in a meeting. You know, even if you're remote and you have a meeting, it's a group. You know, if you go, if I'm in committees, that's a group. Mm. And so learning how to be with other people with maybe very different ideas, very different opinions, very different work ethic, right? And trying to understand that. So that actually the end of COVID is what really started me to open up my classes to those group activities.
Right, it felt like... even just socially so necessary in a way that felt different.
That's how I felt. I was trying to be, you know, that place where they can start socializing again.
Yeah.
You know, and not being afraid of that.
Yeah.
Or in other words. So it worked out and I still use that. You know, I still use it. But I've involved, the one thing I have kept is I have outlined each chapter for each class for the students that don't take very good notes. And most anything I've done is actually because of there might have been a barrier for me when I was in school.
Right.
And I would take notes, very, very long notes, and I would listen and write down everything the professors were saying. But then I'd go home to read them. And I have no idea what I wrote.
Yeah.
And so I do, and we can type all day long. I mean, I don't allow computers because I want to have it interactive. Mm-hmm. And I hand them, I give them the notes for each chapter. So they can listen, and then I say, listen, and then look at the notes, and then maybe if you need to, the example I'm giving, jot down, you know, next to those notes.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like maybe a building block to other classes when you maybe not have that option. Even typing, you know, might not have that option to type out notes. So I do try to help those students, you know, every student. And I'll even ask, does anybody want the notes for the next module? They're like, yes. And I was like, okay, I have them. Because it helps them. It helps them participate. It helps them to listen and not be so focused on writing everything down.
Well, and you talked about how, like, a lot of that is shaped by your own experience.
Yes, very much so.
As a student. And it sounded like that is... You went to community college.
I'd started at Triton.
Wow. So they kind of, even once you get in back to Waubonsie, that probably felt a little bit full circle for you then.
Oh, absolutely. That was probably, you know, it was a very decision-making part of my life.
Yeah.
Is going to Triton and then going and having those professors that mentored me were the classes that I would be struggling in. Or the professors that just made the class so much fun and a learning experience. And so I wouldn't want to teach anywhere else. I love the students that come here. You know, the majority of them, they have jobs or they have families that they're taking care of. I just wouldn't want to be. I love working in my community.
And so you mentioned that your time at community college at Triton, was that one of the first times taking psychology classes there? Was that one of the first times that you were thinking deeply about psychology on an academic level there? Or did you have that interest kind of beforehand too?
I had I went to an all-girl Catholic school. And so...
Talk about a unique social experience.
Yeah, it was. Well, I was sent there because my father, rest his soul, had said, I can't send you to a public school because of your mouth. That's what he said. And I look back now and I'm like, man, he was right. And so I did have a psych class in high school, but it was co-ed psych class, which for me, being with all girls and then having a co-ed class, I had a really hard time concentrating and, you know, sitting still type of thing. And it was very awkward for me. And no other way, though, that other than I was just not used to that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I do remember that. I remember that class, but for that reason. And I remember the teacher. But I think that Triton's, you know, started the fire as far as the academic part of it. But All through grade school and high school, like I said, that's really what I felt like. Things are occurring in people's lives sometimes for a reason, and we may not know. And I felt like I would be really good at helping people and being a counselor or whatever it may be because I've had these experiences and I've been in those shoes. And so that was, I think, probably what started the personal venture.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Triton and the psych class. And then I went to National Lewis University and those classes were phenomenal. And that's really, I think, where it really struck that, yeah, I really like this a lot.
Yeah.
I was able to, like, combine all that personal stuff, which is ironically what I do, right? Combine all that personal stuff with theory to go behind it and behavior explanations to go behind it. And then I just kept pursuing that all the way through. That was human services psych for my bachelor's. And then that's really, I guess, what solidified that.
Yeah. Well, it's cool that even from a young age that you thought, not only is this something that maybe I want to do, like maybe I want to help people, mm-hmm. but also that you're like, I think based on my experience that I would mm-hmm. also, I think I could be good at this too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think, I mean, then when I started, because when I started working in the psychiatric hospital, I was doing floral design because I...
Floral design?
Floral design. I'm a very odd...
Do you still do floral design?
I absolutely love it. Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
I don't do it professionally, but if someone brings me some flowers, I'll design them, you know, and a horticulturist. So I love, my mom like, keeps giving me these plants to bring back to life. And so finally I'm like, you're no longer getting this plant back. I've brought it back to life 3 times. It's mine now. So I have it. I look at it every day. But I was teaching floral design because I was working at Jewel as a floral manager. And the person at Madden or the psych hospital called and asked if I wanted to teach classes there. And then So now I was working within those realms and I thought, now for sure I know I love it. You know, I love it. I need to understand this more. I need to understand, you know, the diagnoses and the behaviors behind all this. And so that I just kept pushing and pushing into psych. And I had a supervisor there that said, you can do anything you want. So it just might take a little bit of time, but you can do anything you want. So I need you to do this, and I need you to get this certificate, and I need you to get this. And so I ended up getting a whole bunch of different certificates so I could help the patients in a whole different way. And then I continued to go to school and continued to have children and saw that once I was done with my bachelor's and I was working there, I started my master's degree in human services and psych. And I got a paid internship, and it all kind of flowed into the next. And every little piece was telling me, yeah, you're going to be able to do this, and this is probably what you're going to do the best at. You know, finding that passion. You know, not chasing a paycheck, finding that passion. And I say that all the time. You know, money's one thing, but you really have to like what you're doing. And there's nothing I love more than getting up in the morning and coming to work.
Yeah.
In summer, I miss it. You know, I mean, I have enough to keep me busy, but I do miss it. You know, I miss the people. I miss the students.
Yeah, you know, I think about it from my own work as a journalist, right? Like, I think about when I first started doing it, the thing that I was the most concerned with was, am I going to be able to keep thinking of story ideas? And, like, am I going to keep having that?
Yeah.
And I realized pretty early on that, you know, the more experience you have, the more you're able to find those things. And also, so often you do one story and that leads you to the next one. And that leads you to the next one and the next one, even in ways that you don't necessarily expect. And it sounds like that was the case for you too in your career, right? One thing leads to the next. And, you know, I need to get the certificate because I want to help people in this way and in this way and this way.
Yes.
And that, I'm sure, just continues to happen to you where you keep following that curiosity into the next thing.
Yes, for sure. So getting my master's and then teaching here with that master's degree, it was human services counseling, and then getting that degree and then teaching here part-time with that degree. But then I started doing education with the patients. I started, we were the only state facility at the time that had a GED program because I just did everything I could to get that for the patients. And so I realized in that part, it's a different level of education, right? But it's still education. So I was doing that for the longest time and became the chief GED examiner. And thought, and I'm like, wow, you know, I was young. And I'm like, that's a good title.
It is. It's got chief in it. Yeah.
And so that really starting those fires again, like with education and seeing, you know, where I could go. And I think then working through that and seeing education mixed with, you know, in a sense, human behavior and psychology was definitely passion for me. And then, you know, continuing, and I got another master's again, and then I got my PhD, and all of that has taught me so many different things, you know, whole different avenues of looking at parenting in my dissertation. You know, the psychology master's degree, you know, I really focused on development because I knew at the time that Waubonsie was looking for someone that teaches to teach development classes. So I really focused on that. And so bigger dive into that. So things was perpetually unfolding for me.
One of the questions we like to ask everyone is about educators they've had in their lives that made a big impact on them. It could be a teacher that you had as a student. It could be a teacher, educator who you've worked with here. It could be just anyone that you see as like an educator or mentor in your life. Just anyone, again, that you feel like made a huge difference on you.
I mean, and it's funny, though, because there's always, you know, three people that stick in my head. My seventh grade teacher was the first teacher that I had that was not a nun.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And so I went to a Catholic grade school and then a Catholic all-girl high school. So, and I felt, and she just, the nuns were great too, you know, don't get me wrong, but it was just so different. And she, the way that she was patient with everybody. And she, I can remember her taking her time with me in reading assignments and things like that. But then in college, at the psychiatric hospital, I had, I think I just mentioned, I had a supervisor that Camille just taught me to just do what you have to do. Get what you need to get. There's something else here. Do it. What do you need to do to get that? So, you know, adult basic education and so many different continuing education certificates. And so that's when I realized that, you know, I can pretty much do anything I put my mind to. It might take me a little bit longer, depending on life. But she was a huge part of me being so young and believing in myself. And then there in one of my graduate degrees, I had a professor that I was going to quit because I was burned out. And she took me out in the hallway and she's like, you're not quitting. You're almost done. And he's like, and she's like, I know you're going to do good. Whatever you decide, I'll never forget it. And I was really never afraid of anybody. I was a little bit afraid of her. Just a tad, a little bit. But here, I can't even begin. My family's so important to me, you know, but To work here with the faculty here is a pleasure. I'm not the only one that, like, when I receiving an award for outstanding faculty is for all of us. I'm just representing all of them. They are dedicated, professional, time-giving, amazing people. And it's a pleasure for me to work with each and every one of them. It's like my family here, you know, that's like, I have my family here and I have my family there. We keep adding to the family here and it just keeps getting better.
And then we have two that we normally finish with. One of them will be more specific to psych and one of them will be more general to just teaching. So we'll start with the more general one, which is just, what's something about teaching you wish more people knew?
I wish that, I mean, I don't know if it's a wish, but I...
Or you think it's more important than people might realize.
When we look at the developmental stage of adolescence, that's the ones that are in school and college. And I just wish that everybody understood the pattern of brain development for adolescents and to be a little bit more patient. And what adolescence starts at 10, right? And so just be a little bit more patient with, you know, they may, the pattern of their brain development, it's not that they don't know, it's just that their brain may not be able to say, if I do this, this will happen.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that patience, and I try so hard every day, even with the class clown that emerges, you know, or to have patience with that age group. And I even did, in the public library, I did a speech or a lecture for parents and adolescents. Way back, and that was a big part of it, just patience. You know, they're trying. There's only so much they can do.
Yeah.
And so I've had that raising my own kids, right? And I didn't have patience all the time, but I did understand that sometimes decisions are being made that they didn't realize that there was going to be this consequence.
You don't ever snap and you go, I know about parenting. Look at the dissertation.
I mean, sometimes. Like, they say you're an expert in parenting, but no, I'm not.
And again, I think that flows perfectly into the second part of it, which is going to be what's something about learning about psychology you think is more important than people might realize? Just something you wish more people knew about.
Oh, health psychology is my baby. I've had quite the challenges in life and with my family and health circumstances and things. And let me tell you, I live by stress will kill you. Stress is no good. And my students in every class have to do a stress card, what they can do every day to de-stress. Because oftentimes we're running, and we don't take the time to just stop and de-stress. Because no matter if you think you're stressed or not stressed, you know, you release cortisol in traffic. And so we need to counteract that. And so my huge baby, and they all know it, everybody knows it, is health psychology, is that how our mind and our body interact and how our own mind can make us sick. And I think that's huge too. And I counteract my stress every day, no matter what, if it's to take a 20-minute nap, which my sons say is not a nap, but a 20-minute nap, or if
that's
I...
That's efficient.
I mean, and I put my head down 20 minutes and then I'm up to finish my day.
Yeah.
And so that's huge for me, is for people to de-stress every day. Even if you think you're not stressed, you still have to do something for yourself, that intrinsic for yourself, just because it's fun. Go take a walk, go sit with your dogs or your cats, or
eat oranges,
right? Eat oranges, whatever it may be, every day. Even if it's 5 or 10 minutes every day, you have to do something for yourself.
Well, that health psych thing, the mind body connection, right? Yes. That's something that I think everybody understands intuitively, but it helps so much to have the language behind it to be like, actually, I'm not crazy. We can back up. Here's the research behind it. Here's all the, you know, specific terminology that backs that up.
Correct. Yeah. And that is the last chapter in the intro to psych class. And that's and it's a good space for it, because that's when, you know, we're ending the semester.
Yeah.
And that's when most students are most stressed. So
yeah, and you got to prepare them for leaving the classroom, where they're not going to have someone to keep reminding them about it.
Yep, correct. And I make them make cards, and I'm like, yes, you're in college, but you're going to be doing a creative index card of the 10 things you can do and how to de-stress every day. I don't have time. Yes, you do. You have to make time.
That was my conversation with Dr. Lisa Fazio-Thelk, psychology professor at Waubonsie Community College. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. And as always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Lisa. Send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And please keep sending your story ideas so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. Wherever you're hearing the show, subscribe, leave us a rating, share it with a friend. It's the best way to get even more perspectives on the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. I've been your host, Peter Mudlin, and we'll be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.